Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, darlings. Bonjour, mes amis. Comment ça va? I hope we're all ça va bienning tonight. This is Sybil Brunchen, broadcasting to you live Monday night, the day after Mother's Day in 2019. And I'm coming to you, yes, back in Manhattan, from the top of the Chrysler Building in the revolving ballroom of the Café Berlin, an Art Deco cauchemar, if you will. And I'm here with my wonderful producer and muse, Gwendolyn Holden Berry, who's holding down the fort in the control room. Gwendolyn, how are you tonight?
I'm a little sad tonight, Mommy, but doing.
Yeah, I was agreeing with you. I said yes. It's a sad day in entertainment. Yeah, go on. How are you doing?
I found myself when I was between raindrops today, sitting out under the tree singing, you know, the glass bottom boat.
As opposed to que sera, sera, right?
Well, you know, when we were little kids, we'd go to Pal's Captain's Table in Deerfield Beach, and it was a big deal. It was a nice, big, beautiful restaurant on the water, and they had those guys that had those little, like, rolling pianos, you remember, back in the day?
Of course. Yeah.
And my mom would have him come over and he'd play every time we were there. He'd play for us, my sister and I, que sera, sera.
Yeah. Well, folks at home, this is indeed Come Now, Don't Sulk, live podcast coming to you from the Here Be Monsters Network on Blog Talk Radio. And Gwendolyn Holdenberry is my wonderful producer from the Here Be Monsters Network. I want to remind you that you can call in tonight live and chat with us. The phone number for our show is 323-784-9639. That's 323-784-9639. I wish it spelled something, but it doesn't. Mummy's other phone numbers over her life have spelled all sorts of interesting or even lewd and naughty things, but this one spells nothing, so you'll just have to write it down with your Crayola crayons. 323-784-9639. Call in and chat with us. Our subject tonight is life, the meaning of life. It's the greatest mystery, the greatest journey, the greatest lesson of all. What it is to have a long life, what it is to have a meaningful life, what it is to even be alive. Are there people that are living but not really alive? Are there people who have been dead for years but are pretending to be alive and are just walking around in a stupor? All the different aspects of life and how it works and how it sometimes doesn't work. And our guest star tonight, which is an interesting metaphor for the whole thing, is Doris Day, who seemed to be the happiest, sunniest, bubbliest creature that Hollywood ever produced, the most untroubled. She lived to be 97 years old in remarkably good health. She weathered four unfortunate marriages and had the heartbreak that many parents, every parent dreads, burying her own child. Her one son, Terry, died of melanoma but had been a music producer, and they were extremely close, which is lovely. But she also went through the heartbreak of losing her son. She went through the heartbreak of losing most of her fortune through, you know, mismanagement by her lawyer and one of her husbands. And but she managed also to create all sorts of extraordinary philanthropy. Her causes for animals, all animals, is legendary. Legendary support of animal welfare. She was awarded. She was honored and awarded throughout her life. She didn't win an Oscar, but she did win. I have it right here. I've got to find it. What was it? She was nominated, believe it or not. For those of you that don't know this, she was nominated for a presidential Medal of Freedom. Hold on one second. She turned down a tribute from the American Film Institute for her lifetime achievement and a Kennedy Center honors, and she turned those two down but because she had to be present to receive them. You can't receive them in absentia. She would have had to have gone there, and she wasn't able to go. But in 2004, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by George Bush. She had an extraordinary life. She survived so many things. Here's a detail about her that's amazing. When TV had basically disemboweled the film industry in the 60s, and TV was, you know, just hammering the film industry flat, the only things that film could come up with were spectacles like Spartacus and Ben-Hur. That was where the film studios felt they could compete against the little box in everyone's living room. So the little box couldn't compete with that. You know, Cinerama and wraparound screens and spectacles like, you know, El Cid and all those great, great epic things that Charlton Heston mostly had a monopoly on. What she managed to do and what the film industry managed to do was to nuke that by producing the romance, the comedy romances of Doris Day with Rock Hudson, James Garner, David Niven, Rod Taylor. And she managed to be one of the few people who was the top box office draw 4 years. Three of them in a row. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, she was 1960, 62, 63, and 64. She missed out, I think, on 61, but I'm sure someone will correct me and be very snarky about it. But the bottom line is that she's one of the few entertainers in the history of Hollywood. Now, think about this. This includes like Shirley Temple, who nuked the competition during the Depression. Gary, you know, Marlene Dietrich? No. Gary Cooper? No. Clark Gable? No. Shirley Temple, at the age of 5, was a juggernaut of money. The film studios looked at her and said, that is the surest creature to bring in a hit during a crushing depression. In the 60s, when television was hammering film and the industry, the film industry, and that's when you saw all those character actors leaving the movies and going to TV. So you saw all sorts of actors going to the Dick Van Dyke Show and Bewitched. All those people that had been in film or were trying to be in film gave up and went over to the TV studios. Doris Day, with Rock Hudson, hammered and managed to be the top box office draw. Isn't that amazing? So she was just, at one point, she was a superstar. And there was an article many years ago and an interview. I can't remember who the interview was, who was involved. But I remember that people said that Doris Day and Rock Hudson were truly, truly the last film studio stars. After them, what happened was actors truly became free agents. Their agents and managers became the studio heads. They were the ones that wheeled and dealed and dealt and created the careers of these people. But that Doris Day and Rock Hudson were truly the last, quote unquote, movie stars of the old studio system. After that, everyone after them was, independent. So, you know, even as Bette Davis and Joan Crawford were doing, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and Bette Davis and Olivia de Havilland were doing Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, they were the generation or the two generations before Rock Hudson and Doris Day. One other thing I want to point out about Doris Day is her credentials as a generous and unafraid humanitarian did not just extend to animals. She, like Elizabeth Taylor, were absolutely at the cutting edge of bravery when AIDS was terrifying everyone from Hollywood to the White House. Yeah. And by the way, you Republicans and your almighty Ronald Reagan and his wife, his B-actress wife, when they had been supported and surrounded by gays in Hollywood through their careers, and they turned their back on the AIDS catastrophe, Doris Day and Elizabeth Taylor were unafraid to embrace both emotionally and physically their pal, Rock Hudson, even as he was disintegrating in front of the American public. I mean, his appearances on television were shocking. People couldn't figure out, was he dying of leukemia? What was it? As he wasted away, they continued to be supportive and loving to him, even as he, you know, disintegrated. And so the amount of praise that we can heap on Doris Day, it cannot be underestimated. She was amazing. And so tonight I'm inviting people to call in. I have a phone call. I have one right now, and I'm going to take it, but I just want to say that I welcome you all to call in, and we'll talk about Doris Day, and we'll talk about how do people survive misfortunes? How do we stay sunny in the face of catastrophe? Anyway, caller, how are you? Who is this on the phone? Hello?
Hi, yes, can you guys hear me? Hello?
Yes, yeah. Who is this?
Yes, my name's David. How you doing?
David, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling in. Happy Mother's Day after the fact. Our subject tonight, although we don't have to stick to it, is life, you know, as inspired by Doris Day's amazingly long life, 97 years old and everything, and how she managed to survive all sorts of things. We were just asking people how they feel about that or Doris Day or whatever. What would you like to talk about tonight?
I was going to address more of the issues we brought up earlier, but specifically the way.
I'm sorry, I'm losing you, David.
Yeah, I was hoping to address more specifically issues pertaining to the whole LGBT movement in the country right now and what's going on.
Oh, well.
And that sort of ties into the point you brought up.
It does, in a way, yeah. What observations? Yeah, what do you have to say about that? I mean, it's apropos of the upcoming, battle with who the Democratic nominee is or how the GOP has seemingly turned its back completely on the LGBTQ cause. What exactly would you like to address?
Yeah, in a way, I think the Republicans doing that is a reflection of what's going on in the country. What I mean by that is this, is that publicly, it's kind of similar to the effect we saw in the 2016 election, which is there's this political correct sort of pressure in society. And many people are now at the point where they're afraid to actually share what they really view, how they feel about certain issues. And so people have to go with this sort of facade and go along with the sort of political correct stance on a lot of issues. And it gives people this perception that the country is a certain type of way, when in reality there's a large majority that are very different than what they think, but they're just afraid to say it because they don't want to be attacked or they don't want to be bullied or whatever. And that especially applies to the LGBT issue, because what's going on now is, I call this, it's almost like a double standard. 10, 20 years ago, when the Christians were getting heavily involved in politics, the common refrain I heard from people, especially people who were more secular, was it's not right for Christians to be trying to impose their views and their values on other people. Especially, it's not right for them to be getting in politics and doing it and trying to use it legislatively. But today, that's precisely what the LGBT community is doing. They're literally imposing their views on society as a whole, demanding that you accept it, and they're using politics to use that as to leverage over people. And so
when you say accept it,
when you say
accept it, what do you think of course, first of all, we can't speak for all the millions of different gay and lesbian people and bisexual, et cetera. But when you say trying to impose it on the public, explain that to me. What do you think? For instance, let's talk about the Christian thing. Christians, and this is going on today, are still apparently, even though this country has become even more multi-faith than it was. I mean, now we have huge numbers of Hindus, Sikhs, Muslims, Buddhists, I mean, everything possible here. Whereas in the 50s, it was Christians and Jews, and you might know one Islamic person, one Muslim person. It's become much more multidimensional now. And Christians are still, in many parts of the country, trying to impose their faith on local government, on morals, on mores, and on education. They're trying to separate. They're still trying to teach creationism in public schools, which is almost inconceivable. So how, explain to me, because I'm curious, how is the LGBTQ crusade, or if you will, or lifestyle, how is that trying to do the same thing? Explain that to me.
Okay, so if you go back about more than about 10, say 20 years ago, homosexuality was still viewed by many as an immoral behavior. It was something viewed as like an evil act. So what the LGBT movement is attempting to do is trying to change that and make it culturally acceptable and considered morally acceptable and make it as if there's nothing wrong with it. Right? That's that's their goal here, what they're trying to do. And so along with there was a whole host of misinformation they had to produce in order to justify that. One of the primary ones.
What is the misinformation? Yeah, tell me that.
Okay, then let's get into it. So the primary one is this idea, because if people had the perception that homosexuality was a behavior that people chose or what they somehow got through certain, you know, different influences, it was harder to convince the general public to accept it. So they realized we have to convince the public that people are born gay, and if we do that, then people will be more willing to accept it as normal. And so how do they do that?
So do you think – let me ask you something. Do you think gay behavior or gay sexuality, do you think that being gay is a choice?
No, not a choice. It's a mental illness. We know this scientifically. Let's go back to how they pulled the wool over the eyes of the American people.
Gwendolyn, let me handle this. So, David, you're saying that you believe that LGBTQ behavior – and instincts and attraction to other people is a mental illness.
Yes, it is. And I'll show you how.
Before you say that,
according
I just
to the American
to
Psychiatric
something.
Association, well, let's talk the facts here. My personal opinion doesn't mean anything. The American Psychiatric Association, as of 1976, classified homosexuality and transgenderism as mental illnesses under the category of paraphilia. Now, that changed not because they found new information or new research or new studies were done to change their position on that. They put a letter out explaining that they did it purely out of political pressure. And if you knew what was happening during that time, especially in 1976, the LGBT activists were going into these meetings, conferences, shouting them down, protesting, demanding that they change it. And the American Psychiatric Association succumbed to the political pressure. And they stated so in the letter when they did that. Now, there's never been any evidence to show otherwise. And so if you're going to give me your personal subjective opinion and say, well, no, I believe they're born gay, that's one thing. I'm going off what was proven scientifically through years and years of study. And so that has to be put on the table. Now, that information is not put out to the general public because the LGBT movement doesn't want that out there, because they want the narrative. They want the idea in the general public's mind that people are born gay. This is some type of genetic thing. But remember, the Human Genome Project, which mapped out the entire – XY chromosomes, found no evidence of a gay gene, none whatsoever. So that's not even on the table anymore.
Can I ask you something?
People know that.
Okay, I'm online right now. I'm on the internet. And where can I find a link to this to your claim? I'm trying to look this up.
So. Yeah, so give me the American Psychiatric Association.
I'm on American Psychiatric Association, and then
just look up. They put out it's almost like an encyclopedia of mental illnesses. It's known as the DSM, the acronym. There's under different titles, but you can look up if you want to Google search. Just to make it simpler for you, just look up.
That's what I'm doing.
Homosexuality removed from the DSM, or no longer classified as a mental illness.
I'm already there, but I don't find the claim that it was pressured by political stuff. I'm trying to find that. Where do I find that?
No, okay, you have to look up the American Psychiatric Association's letter on why they no longer classified homosexuality and transgenderism as mental illnesses. You might want to put that as a specific search.
Homosexuality. Okay, I'm entering this. No longer... Why is homosexuality no longer?
Yeah, why they no longer classified it as that? Because they put out a letter specifically explaining why they took it out of the DSM.
Well, I've got that, but it doesn't say that this was political pressure. I've got that, but I don't think it doesn't say that's political pressure.
Oh, you can find it. I've read it myself. You can find it out there. That's their explanation as to why. because they were clear. They did not do it because they found new studies or any evidence that they discovered that made them change their position. They did it purely out of political pressure.
But where can we find that?
When the DSM-5 came out. You should be able to find it. I don't know why you're not able to find it.
Because I've got all of this. I've got this wonderful link right now that says depathologizing homosexuality. And it's all, but it doesn't say that they did it because they were pressured. It's just, let me see. No, it's going on. So I'm very eager to find the link as a result, cultural change in the U.S. and other countries as those who was accepted. It's no longer considered an illness. It's going on, but I'm not finding the conspiracy. I'm not finding the thing that says.
It was very clear. I mean, when they released the DSM-5, that was one of the key questions I was asked. Why now in the DSM-4, why was it classified as a mental illness and why is it no longer in the DSM-5? And they put out a letter, I believe it was in a press release, where they explained their position as to why they no longer did that. And they were clear and they were adamant that
they didn't mention Alfred Kinsey in that.
No, they were just addressing the point.
Nor
as
the
to
comparative,
why the question was being
the comparative social science researching that went on between Ford and Beach. If you're going to come up with information, back it up.
David, I'm very eager to find
this. I'm stating the position.
It was
Hooker's of the American Psychiatric Association.
And I'm right on there. I'm right on their encyclopedic website, the one that you pushed to get into. And Hooker's study in 57 was innovative in several respects due to this.
I don't want to take up
so
the whole show.
So you're bringing up a study in 57,
yeah,
but let's remember,
yeah,
they still considered it a mental illness as of 1976 under paraphilia.
Okay. Folks. Unfortunately, this is only an hour-long show, and we're already 20 minutes into it. David, thank you so much for bringing this up. I would love to have that letter, the link to that letter. So if you will message me on Facebook with that information, I would love to find that letter because I'm going through during this, as I always do, I'm going on my laptop to all these different links on this, and I can't find the letter declaring that they had been railroaded
I think Wikipedia actually has the link on that because they actually describe
it. Oh, Wikipedia.
As well.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
No,
well, the bottom line
you
is,
want to
is
find
that
a
if
link
you
to
could.
It because they cite it on a reference.
Okay. Well, folks at home, according to David, the American Psychiatric Association was basically railroaded into declaring LGBTQ behavior and sexuality. And that it was in fact an illness. It still is a mental illness, according to David and according to other people. And I welcome my home listeners to find that link and send it to me because you know how encyclopedic I am. I love having all sorts of stuff put in my files for easy reference. So if you, David, or anyone else at home.
You think that homosexuality people are born that way? You think it's genetic?
First of all, in my position, I just have to tell you that I don't think it's a choice. I think that it is.
Well,
David, let me finish the answer, okay? So you're kind of one of those people that takes a breath and talks. I don't feel it's a choice, and that's a big, big part of the GOP right-wing agenda, is that people are just choosing this behavior, and that's why they get away, like Mike Pence, our satanic vice president, with claiming that people could fix themselves, and Indiana is the center of all restructuring of this behavior. So I don't believe it's a choice. I don't believe it can be corrected out of a person. I don't think you can become heterosexual just by wishing and praying. Let me finish. And electroshock therapy or all those things that, the scientologists have
been doing. I got
that,
but we're talking about mental illnesses. You can't choose a mental illness.
And I certainly don't think.
People don't choose to be schizophrenic, right?
And that's where I must say I seriously disagree. I don't think homosexuality can be compared to schizophrenia or to bestiality or to child molestation.
No one chooses
I don't think
that. But it's an unnatural desire that does. First of all, logically doesn't.
No, there's homosexuality in animal species as well, and it's not just geese.
There's also cannibalism. You can't look to the animal world to like justify human behavior.
David,
the head of her
David,
moment as she's as they're meeting. Is that you going to justify that?
David,
come on,
man.
I just have to tell you, I've treated you with incredible hospitality and respect on this radio show. And for you to compare homosexuality, Gwendolyn, I hope you're standing by, for you to compare homosexuality and cannibalism is insulting and
disgusting. No, I'm just saying you brought up animal behavior.
Go support Donald Trump. No.
I
know exactly where you're
cannibalism.
Coming from.
I'm
I cannot have a neo-fascist
it.
On the show. Gwendolyn, this call is at an end.
I just ended it for you, my friend, and just
I
for,
will not accept for, cannibalism and homosexuality.
Like,
poor David.
Like
poor David.
We do have a caller waiting. Before that caller comes, David was referring to the removal from the DSM, and that happened in 1973. I found the information from the American Psychiatric Association. There was a
Good.
Large there was a large hoo-ha about it,
right.
But the weight of
okay.
the empirical data it supported that this was not a psychiatric pathology. It was something
right.
born with, and it has remained so, even though there are a few old Freudian folk who will argue about it. But what
right.
he was talking about was not a letter. It was a petition that went around amongst the old guard that said it was a pathology.
Right. Thank you for clarifying that. And now we know, listeners at home, and David, if you're still listening to the podcast, that's what it was. It was a petition, and that's fine. And we can get petitions signed for people who still think the earth is flat, okay? There are people who still think the earth is flat because when they walk out their door, they don't find themselves walking off the edge of the earth. They don't see a curve in the earth, okay? So there you go. Okay, who's our next caller, Gwendolyn?
Well, already on board. Go ahead, caller. Your mic is open.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, who's this?
I don't know if I'm the...
Hello?
Hello, this is Jan Glazier in California.
Jan, how are you?
Fine. I'm like blown away here. This is Doris Day's day. And and I want to talk a little bit about her because I think she's just the most amazing, star we have had in ages. But I also want to tell you that today, Richard and I went down to try out for Antiques Roadshow.
Wonderful.
Isn't that fabulous?
I tried out for it, too, a few years ago. And actually, I appear on an episode in the New York City one in the background.
Oh.
I'm one of the people who's talking with an expert about something I brought. What did you take?
Well, we took two scripts that we have that belong to the director, Norman Taurog. And
right.
the script is for presenting Lily Mars with Judy Garland and Van Heflin.
Yes.
And Girl Crazy with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland.
Oh,
and
we
did those, were those scripts Norman's or were they Judy's?
Oh, they were Norman's. I mean, they belong to, MGM, but name, his signature. And the interesting thing is that you look at the pages – and he or his assistant lined through the text, the script as it was filmed. So they
right.
knew when things were done, and if somebody ad-libbed or they changed on the fly wording, that's notated. And they're beautifully bound, and they're very, very
right.
cool. But
I've handled many of those scripts over the years. I've handled many of those scripts, both first of all, I've owned many of those. I've held many of those scripts and handled them and read them in the position of possession of friends or in shops that were, you know, general and typewritten and all of that and bound. But I've also handled a couple and looked at, through a couple that belong to celebrities. And they're so interesting to see notes from famous actors in the margins and you know, crossed out and change. And then a question mark, you know, will L.B. Mayer approve of this line change? You know, will Michael Curtiz be okay?
Exactly,
check with Michael Curtiz. Exactly.
How
exciting.
They're of extreme interest to a certain group of people, but apparently not in their minds to the, you know, the general public. But we had such a good time. It was such a wonderful experience. And, you know, anyway,
those would have been on the air. Those would have been taken instantly if only they had been Judy Garland's with her handwriting.
I think
our mutual friend, John Fricke, has a script or two that had been Judy Garland's, and they are you know, it's like, holy grail, you know.
we stood in line for quite a while.
Can you imagine if you had had a Judy Garland, they would have gone nuts if you had opened that and Judy Garland's notes had been in there and stuff. That would have been amazing.
That's true.
First of all, you would have been the starring thing on the show. And secondly, what would they have appraised it at? Like $10,000, $50,000?
Who knows? It's like priceless, basically. These, unfortunately, were not priceless. But, you know, she was very interested. But she lives down in L.A. and she's seen a million of these
kinds of
things, like you say. And so, but, you know, we had a nice time. We had a wonderful time, actually. And it took about, 3 hours. To get from parking to standing in line to getting, you go through a first thing where they decide who you're going to talk to. I mean, in a category. So we were in collectibles, and
of course.
And then we got somebody who really knows all. And actually, ironically, Richard had talked to about appraising our collection after we die. So my daughter will know what she's got, you know, what to,
well,
you know.
Well, Dan, how much were they appraised at?
Oh, what'd she say? Like $1,000 or something a piece, you know.
Well, that's not bad at all.
It was a lot more than we paid for them. But anyway,
that's
fun
pretty
experience.
Fancy.
It was
especially
a fun experience.
Especially in this age of, like, people not caring about antiques, you know, as much as they did 25 years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
The market for all antiques, for all collectibles.
Oh, it's gone way down. Yeah, it's sad.
Has plummeted. So for you to have $2,000 scripts, and listen, I love Norman Tarrant.
Well, he was a big...
I love Norman Tarrant's work, but he's not Michael Curtiz or William Wyler or... Don Ford.
No.
I mean, those are like, oh,
no.
My God.
He did a lot of Elvis films is maybe what he's most famous for. But he did, you know, a lot with Judy at MGM. Girl Crazy. Think of Girl Crazy. My gosh. Anyway, so that's what we did today. But, you know, when I got home and I found out about Doris, I thought, oh, my gosh. You know, what can we say about Doris? She's just, you know, she had such an incredibly sad personal life. And yet she brought so much happiness and greatness to the world and, you know, just beauty. And I'm very emotional about Doris.
But when you say a sad personal life, I mean, her life.
Oh, terrible.
Though
terrible.
Four divorces and her son died and everything. But on the other hand, she had a son who adored her to the end of his life.
Oh,
and,
that's true.
Though she lost all her money, she got it all back. In a lawsuit, she got most of it back.
Some of it, anyway. So who knows?
She made a few personal appearances in her hotel in Carmel, and
she was
just great with people when she did.
You know,
that.
Here's the irony of that: we, Richard and I, had a beautiful little Bichon named Sophie that we adored, and we kept saying we got to go down to the car. You know, what was the name of it? It was in Carmel for hotel because we just knew, because at that time she would go in and meet people. And, you know, this is years ago, and we just never did it. And then, you know, Sophie died. And now Well, Doris hasn't done that for years, but she's what a wonderful person. That's all I have to say. Just a wonderful human being.
What was your favorite movie of hers?
Oh, Romance on the High Seas, the very first one. She's like somebody you see the first time your mouth drops open and you're in love forever because she's so great. So, you know, just brilliant. And she jumps off the screen. That's all I can tell you. If you haven't seen that one, you really, that's where, it's magic.
Right.
That song
that's,
she
introduced. Yeah, that's
that
where it was.
Oh, God.
I am.
Your mouth had to drop open the first time you saw her. It had to drop open. So I did, but, you know, I already knew her. But the very first audiences who didn't know who she was, unless they, like, went to a, you know, to see her sing with a band or something, and there she is, that beautiful face, that personality, that song, you know, the singing. She's just a wonderful, wonderful woman.
Right.
And,
it's interesting. One of my favorite stories about her is that if she was born in 1922, she lived to be 97. And by the way, the photographs of her in old age, she is recognizable, even very elderly with no makeup on. You can still see, that's Doris Day. And secondly, she's a beautiful Doris Day. She's a beautiful elderly Doris Day.
Yes.
It's like she wasn't ruined and disfigured by extreme
she
old
was.
Age.
She was a health nut. She was a big health nut. And she had a massage every day.
She even put the dogs on a vegetarian diet if they need, you know, if it was appropriate for them. That's how, you know, she cared about animals. And
one of my favorite stories about her is that she was 22 and she was recovering there's an anecdote here. She was recovering from an auto accident and Doris started to sing along with a radio show that she was listening to on the radio. And she started to sing along with the music on the show and was startled to find that she could sing, which when she told the story and when it's written down, people said, well, wait a minute, you didn't know that you could sing at 8 years of age or nine or you were like Judy Garland, Judy Garland.
As most people would be, Wow.
Right. At 16, she was sort of just singing along and thought she sounded kind of good. And by 17, she was already, she went and took lessons and said, I think I have a good voice and I think I sort of can copy people on the radio. And by 17, she was already professionally hired and was singing, which is so startling. So startling that that's what she was doing. And Romance on the High Seas, what year was that movie? That was like right then. I mean, she was a girl when she was in that.
She was
pretty
young,
And then, of course, she, you know, got into the big band era and was, you know, she went from there. A couple of other facts about her, which is really startling, was that she was the original. This is so startling. She was the original choice for The Graduate. And she refused to play Mrs. Robinson because the role was too creepy for her.
Yeah. anything she would do. Yeah.
Right. And
I think
she said that she thought that the idea of her being in bed, rolling around, quote unquote, in bed with Dustin Hoffman, a man that was like half her age or whatever, was too distasteful. And it was too.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, what's amazing about that is that Anne Bancroft's career got a complete boost.
Oh, got a total boost
from doing that. She got an Oscar nomination and everything.
She made it work, though. And Doris, it would have been so weird and so atypical for her. Don't you think? I mean,
I've got to say, apropos of that, speaking of the 60s and television, who would have thought that Mary Tyler Moore would be a genius sociopath, narcissist in Ordinary People? Who would have thought?
Oh,
And
yeah,
Robert Redford had to beg her to do that. And Mary Tyler Moore's performance in that was electrifying. Mm. And I think it's because comedians, I really believe this, comedians are the greatest talented people in the world because
they can do
everything. Comedy and humor but it comes from dark places. I don't think that all dramatic actors can be comedians, but I think that a lot of comedians can be profoundly brilliant in dark or tragic roles. Jackie Gleason was able Jerry Lewis, yes, King of Comedy. Jerry Lewis on the Law and Order episode where he plays this mildly retarded guy. But Jackie Gleason could take the Honeymooners and with just a pause and a wince in his eye and the way he would move his body, he could instantly break your heart. And I think that Doris Day, it would have been fascinating to see Doris Day do something else. Let's face it, Doris Day was in two movies that were completely not Doris Day. One is kind of a C-plus movie, Midnight Lace. But it's kind of a C-plus.
Yeah.
It's partly because her leading man is just, you know, John Gavin, exquisite to look at, but should never have spoken on film. And the other person is the other movie. And I told him so. I told him so
now,
over lunch one day.
Don't hold back there.
At the Notel Motel, John Gavin and I were having an afternoon, and I told him, I said, "Darling, you're physically exquisite. Stand in front of me naked, but please don't say another word. Never speak again. Just do the naked jumping jacks that I'm paying you for." Okay, and then the other person, the other movie that she was in, which was brilliant, and I think was a brilliant use of her, was The Man Who Knew Too Much. What is genius about it took all of her hokey awkwardness, and she was an ex-celebrity. If you remember the movie, she's an ex-celebrity who has retired because her husband's a doctor. And they took Hitchcock took all of her wholesomeness, her American goofiness and everything, and then unraveled her in front of the camera. Because then she's confronted with a catastrophe of losing her son, and then she's on a murder plot, an assassination plot. And the scene in the Symphony Hall where she's not sure, she knows that something's going to happen, but she's not quite sure when or how it's going to happen. And her fear and everything is amazing. I mean, she's just dazzling when she's cast like that. Yeah. I don't know about you, but the Rock Hudson, James Garner movies, for me, have always been a big scoop of marshmallow fluff.
I couldn't even tell you that I've seen many of them, actually. I like Doris, and here's a case of Doris was kind of, well, not big, but she wasn't tiny, and with Young at Heart with Frank Sinatra, which I love, but she's like bigger than he is.
My God, I can't believe you said that, because in Love Me or Leave Me, she towers over James Cagney.
Oh, well,
towers
over
him.
But that's sort of part of the deal, you know. Yes, she was bigger.
I do love her in Calamity Jane. I think she's funny with Howard Keel. I think that's pretty funny.
Yes.
You know,
she really wanted that. She really wanted that movie.
Are you guys going to keep slamming all those wonderful movies that I run to make me feel better when I'm down? The Thrill of It All, Pillow Talk.
Oh, yeah.
Last Bottom Boy.
How about the one with Cary Grant? How about the one with Cary Grant?
Oh, yeah, what was that?
That was kind of dreamy.
That was a great one.
That Touch of Mink. Touch of Mink. Yeah. I mean, you know, I can relate to Doris getting to be in a movie with, even though she's a huge star, with Cary Grant. Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, all of those movies are very funny because you basically, you take a mattress, you take a bath towel, and you take a pink telephone and a bathtub filled with soap suds. And that's what those movies are. They're always like, she's in a bathtub with a bubble bath, and he's on the other line on a black telephone. He's on a pink telephone, and they're doing a split screen.
Oh,
and that's
so cute. Yeah, so cute.
You know, so
funny. She had a really amazing career when you think of it, really. she's maybe best remembered for those kind of things. But I, you know, I just think she had a fabulous
career.
Oh,
no, I think she's remembered. I really do think she's remembered for a lot of the movies that you guys were discussing. And who was the guy, the standby, Carson, Jack Carson?
She did
some movies with him that were really great, too.
Well, Jack Carson was instrumental in her career.
They were an item, you know, they were an item.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
And he's the one that called her. He called her one time when she was young and said, "Hi, Doris, this is Jack Carson." And she thought he was, she hung up on him because she thought it was a joke. Because she had admired Jack Carson so much. And, of course, it's funny because Jack Carson, to me, I adored Jack Carson, always adored him. And I also thought he was so attractive and cute and funny and everything.
And
a great musical comedy star. And he gave her a break, a big break, and she starred in a movie with him. And so she always thanked him. She was very gracious and graceful and open to him, even if his career disappeared. You know, Jack Carson vanished, basically. But he was a major actor and helped her.
Oh, and they really, they had something going and, you know, in between whatever. And then, did you see the A Star is Born premiere
Jan,
with
wait
Judy?
One second. Is Richard playing in the background?
Yes. He doesn't know
okay.
he can be heard.
Because I'm getting notes on, I'm getting private messages here saying, what is the music? Are you going to address the music?
he's a room away
right now.
On the piano.
He's just saying, who's playing the piano? And Sybil, are you playing the piano while you're doing the show?
Yes. Yes, I am. Or you are. You are.
Anyway, go on. What were you saying about?
Oh, so it's the premiere of A Star is Born with Judy Garland.
Right.
And all the stars come down the you know, walkway or whatever to be spoken to be interviewed. So, you know, and Doris is there with Marty, and she walks up, and who's interviewing at that point in time? Guess.
I have no idea.
Jack Carson.
Oh wow.
He's the one interviewing for the local TV station.
And he's in the movie. And that's so interesting that he's in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. He had a wonderful part. He was great in it. He was the angry,
monstrous. Yeah, the character was monster.
Yeah.
A monster. Yeah.
Really, really great. But for some reason he was doing this thing, and it's just kind of interesting if you know that they had something going, that there's this horrible, and we know now, horrible Marty Melcher and Doris in the middle looking like the angel, you know, and then Jack, and they're just like kind of casual, not, you know, you'd never know, but anyway, interesting.
I'm sure there's tons of that. I mean, once we read the biographies and everything, the intermarriages, the interplay, the affairs, both in front of the camera and behind the camera, all of it.
Right.
So startling. So startling.
Yeah.
What was the other fact about Doris Day? She gave up the role of Mrs. Robinson, but she also, there was something. Oh, are you ready for this one? This is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, this is amazing. She was offered a role on TV, and she turned it down. Do you know what the role was?
Oh, well,
Jessica Fletcher in Murder, She Wrote.
Oh, that would have been perfect.
Is that hysterical?
Wouldn't that have been great? Oh, she would have been terrific. But, you know, we love,
Angela Lansbury, but what
Angela,
who's also
you.
In their 90s, she's 93. Believe it or not, she's younger than Doris Day. I mean, but she's 93.
Yeah.
But the thing that's interesting about it is, so Jessica Fletcher would have, instead of being British and very bird-like and very fluttery, sort of like a contemporary Jane Marple, it would have been a cleaned-up, blonde, well-scrubbed, wholesome Peter Falk. In Colombo, she would have solved mysteries, but not in a trench coat. She would have been like in She would have been in an Angora sweater with petal pushers and cute little ballet slipper shoes.
Oh, she would have made another fortune. She could have saved so many more dogs. Oh my God!
Isn't that so funny? But
yes.
To think of
I love that idea. I love that.
I love when Hollywood is like imagining one thing and ends up with another. And
yeah.
when are they successful things or are they not? It's kind of, it's so
uh-huh.
funny. So funny.
Yeah.
Well,
anyway.
I was looking at all these different things about her. She was nominated for an Oscar. She was nominated for a Best Actress Oscar for,
mm-hmm.
was it Pillow Talk? I think, yeah, possibly
really?
Pillow Talk, which is
yeah.
ironic.
Yeah.
That's really startling. You know, her son, Terry Melcher, you know, escaped being murdered.
Oh,
by
he would
the
have been
Manson
murdered.
Family.
He was the target.
Because he had been a music producer, and
right.
he had had Charles Manson audition for him and had
uh-huh.
met with him a few times, but decided
uh-huh.
that Manson didn't have any talent, nor did his family.
Not, yeah, exactly.
And
he was one of the
instigators of the,
uh-huh.
or he was one of the, not the instigator, but he was the blamed
target.
Yeah,
for, he was a target.
Manson,
that
you
was,
know, yeah.
Yeah.
And they tore down the house. Melcher stayed in
oh,
that
did.
House. The, yeah.
Uh-huh.
The 150 Los Cielo Drive or whatever it is. And they actually tore the house down later. So many people had starved.
Well,
had lived in there.
I wouldn't do
yeah.
anything else with it. Yeah. Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. She had a lot
oh,
of...
Well.
But she found her passion and her goal after her career with the animals.
Oh, yeah.
She was just such a wonderful, human being. And
oh yeah,
you
she
know,
created
a
home
have...
with Cleveland Amory. Avery, I'm sorry, Cleveland
yeah,
Amory.
Amory,
she
yeah.
and Cleveland Amory. No, Cleveland Amory.
Yes. A M O R Y.
O R Y. Was the one who they both started the Doris Day Horse Rescue Center
oh.
in Texas. And they had gone beyond just dogs and cats. They then were
uh-huh.
They created a horse recovery rescue organization.
Yeah.
When you read the list of things
mm-hmm.
that she did for animals, it is astounding.
Yeah.
Mary Tyler Moore, Andy Dickinson, and Jane Meadows. They were four pals that had all joined together and made animals their cause. It goes on and on and on. It's an amazing life, and you know,
amazing.
And an inspiration
amazing.
To all of us.
Oh, for sure, absolutely. I love her. You know, I'll always love her. Anyway,
you know
I just
what?
Wanted to call, and you know, let get the conversation about beautiful Doris on her day. This is her day.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Well, Turner Classic Movies has been poised, as they are all the time.
Oh,
you know, they've been on standby for Olivia de Havilland for over 70 years now. Olivia de Havilland is now 212, and they just are, you know, she outlived Robert. What's his name? Oh my God. She outlived everybody, all the hosts, everyone.
Yeah.
So they're like, they're at this point, Turner Classic Movies is not sure that Olivia de Havilland will ever in fact die, that maybe she will have to just be embalmed and put in a sarcophagus and they'll run her movies.
I thought Doris would never die, but you know, did I tell you that we met Robert Osborne? That
Robert
Richard was
Osborne,
on the very first Turner Classic Movie cruise as an entertainer.
That's nice. Oh,
he
that's
played,
wonderful.
And so he played, you know, like three or four concerts in different parts of the ship during the cruise. And then we got to go to everything. It was all, you know, just free for us. It was fabulous. And one day we were in where the entertainers go.
The green
anyway,
room or the...
VIP. It was a VIP room. And
okay.
so we were having lunch, and we were the only people in there. And
right.
he had been off for a while. He'd been sick. Do you remember when he got sick and he wasn't on for quite
Absolutely.
A while? And then, so his first thing back was this cruise. And I think, honest to God, that's why most people went on it. Because although there was Ernest Borgnine and Tippi Hedren and some others, wonderful, everybody loved Robert Osborne.
Right.
And he walked in that day while we were sitting there having lunch, and he came over the table, and he said, "Hello, I'm Robert Osborne."
Right.
You know, as if we would need to be told.
Right.
And he couldn't have been nicer, more gracious, more wonderful, just exactly what you'd hope. And then everybody on the cruise, these stars, they had segments in a big room where they would talk about their career. They were, you know, they answered questions. It was a really nice thing. And Robert was planned for one. And his thing was the only one that was so overbooked. I don't know how to say it.
Right.
They had to put a second one in. They had to figure out how to put a second one
right.
in because there
right.
were people who were turned away because he was the star of that cruise, as he should have been. And he told
the
story
people.
About how he got it, how he, you know, uh-huh. He was supposed to have, like, dinner with Dorothy L'Amour, and
uh-huh.
she called him up the day of or whatever, very close to it, and she said, well, I have to tell you that I've got this dinner engagement with so-and-so, I can't remember the names, the guys who were going to do, but he didn't know it, Turner Class Movies. And he said, oh, well, that's okay, we'll do it another. She said, no, I want you to come. So he went, and it was these guys, and they're talking about starting a channel that would just be movies, and they're looking for a host. And that's after he's talked, as he did, so expertly and wonderfully and enthusiastically about movies. You know how he was.
Right. Yeah.
And they were just, they were swept away. I mean, I think
that's
they kind of
terrific.
Knew
yeah.
he was going to be good, and that was it. It was just over
that's
a
terrific.
Dinner with Dorothy L'Amour and the guys, and that's
yeah.
how it all started for him. And anyway, he told that story, and, you know, everybody loved him. They just loved him. Anyway,
for those of
so,
you, we're running out of time. I wanted to just mention
okay,
that
I'm sorry.
For those of you at home that don't know, Richard Glaser is a concert pianist whose specialty, and he can play anything, but his specialty and the reason he was on the Turner Classic Movies cruise is because he is one of the great, great American songbook pianists. He can play. He plays Gershwin and Porter and all of the great, great Hollywood film and Broadway musical music. He's just an amazing, amazing musician, and that's why they were on the cruise, and it's a great tribute to him. I'm sorry that we're running out of time. I'm looking at the clock going by, and
sorry,
we could chat so much about everything.
I know.
No, not at
oh,
all.
We
got
you.
Lots of Doris Day. We got lots of Doris Yay. Day in after the psychotic phone call that I got earlier. I think I handled that psychotic phone call very,
we
very well. Mummy
we
has
needed
lots of
Doris
experience.
Day to get us through. That's right.
Right.
God
Mummy had lots of experience working as a candy striper at Payne Whitney, and at Bellevue Hospital. And so I've had experience with people who claim that homosexuality is commensurate with cannibalism. And remind me next week on our show
to
tell you about
that.
Remind me to tell you next week about Mummy's experiences at the Donner Party with strip poker and beef stew. Remind me to tell you about strip poker and beef stew at the Donner Party. Dan, I love you. Give our love to Richard. Tell him
you
to please,
too, honey.
Please close the French doors the next time you call. And I have to tell
okay.
everyone, I'm going to just do our sign-off because I want Gwendolyn to know. Our show tonight, of course, was sponsored, as it always is, by the DaughtersOfIsis.com, fragrant memories of our ancestors. Go to DaughtersOfIsis.com on their website and find out about all their amazing products, which are not only sensual and sensuous and sexual, but they also are mind and spirit expanding. And so please go there, check out their amazing products, and they have some new products for this spring too that you should be checking out. I want you to know that you can find me every day. You can find me every Monday here with Gwendolyn on Come Now, Don't Sulk, which is part of the Here Be Monsters Network on radio, Blog Talk Radio. And I want you to know that you can also find Mummy on SybilSez.com. That's SybilSez.com, SybilBrunchen.com, and on the Sybil Brunchen Lollipop Guild on Facebook, and also on my YouTube channel. We will be back here Monday, 8 o'clock, live. That's Eastern Daylight Time, 7 Central, 6 Mountain Time, 5 Pacific Time, last Wednesday, Hawaiian Time, in China, where I don't know what. They're in February right now. So you'll find Mummy in China for our Chinese listeners right now, whether you're Mandarin or you're the other Chinese. What's the other column? Whatever it is. Column A and Mandarin.
Cantonese.
Cantonese. I simply jet the door. more Cantonese food. Don't you? And I love Mandarin oranges. I'm an equal Chinese food person, Cantonese or Mandarin oranges. I love them, and I love Mandarin collars. Don't be angry with me. I give equal time for fashion. Mandarin collars are adorable. They're just, and they're so Peter Panish, aren't they? Anyway, wait a minute. I just realized something. The Chinese restaurant downstairs is called the Hunan Pan, or is it Human Pan? I'm not sure. We'll find out. Anyway, darling, good night, Jan and Gwen. Will you take us out with our theme song?
Yeah, we love you.
Good night, everybody.
Okay. Good night.
Thank you.